This is a true story.
The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in Wisconsin and New York in 2017.
At the request of the survivors, the names have been changed.
Out of respect for the dead, the rest has been told exactly as it occurred. This is the Better Call Fargo edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the PPD to my OPP, it's Dan.
Good evening, Scott.
Good evening, Dan. it's been a strange week in real life and a fun one in TV life, I'll say.
Yes.
So
that's how it goes nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, it's TV is our respite, and thankfully we have two fine shows to be talking about, so let's get right to the first of our two TV series tonight. So
yeah, The Leftovers, and then we're going to talk about The Americans.
If only. No, actually, tap your ashes on that scale of justice so we can gear up for Better Call Saul. Now, the latest episode was titled Sunk Costs. It was written by Jennifer Hutcheson, who has written several episodes of both Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. She was also an assistant producer on earlier in her career on series such as The X-Files and Mad Men. And it was directed by John Chabon, who has been a writer and a director on a number of series, including Breaking Bad, The X-Files, and Hell on Wheels. So, Dan, let's start with the opening, and we can then go from there to all the mic-related moments throughout this episode. I really love when you get an opening that turns out to be one of those who can really tell how far in the future flash forward that like makes little sense until we see how the storyline plays out here. It kind of reminded me of all the flash forwards we got, say, like in season two of Breaking Bad with the pink teddy bear and the whole swimming pool thing.
Yeah, I pretty much love when any good show does this. You know, just because, like, I enjoy not knowing what's going on and, like, being kind of confused and then knowing that at some point it'll all come together. And I usually pick up on it, you know, before, like, all the information is presented. And it's like, oh, yeah, this is sweet. Of course, I have to deal with, like, my mom sitting there not understanding what's going on and just, like, acting like she's never seen a TV show like this before and, like, doesn't understand why they're not explaining it. But other than that, it's okay.
Right. I mean, what was also cool about this was, unlike, say, the Breaking Bad scenario I just mentioned, at least that was leading to events that were going to occur at the very end of the season. That little, again, flash forward, if you're going to call it that, who knows, that could be a year or two later. You know, exactly how long does it take sneakers to get old and rot and just fall off a wire the way they do there?
Yeah, it could be any length of time between this when this takes place and, you know, I guess close to the end of the end of season four of Breaking Bad, because this could be at any point during that. All it has to do is show what it did and the way it just did it. I mean, it's just so much better than like any like you know exposition or anything. The way they told this in that way, it's just smart and really fucking fun. And I just loved like you know, it, and it made the end scene, which was you know had its fair share of cool. It just made it that much better when like you realize like, oh, that's what he's doing. And like, oh, that's what we saw before. It just like elevates the entire fucking thing.
Oh, yeah. It makes you want to almost go flip it back and watch the opening again and then look for, you know, oh, look, there is actually a bullet hole in the toe of the sneaker or something like that, which apparently there is. So it's really kind of nice the way they did that. And we will be talking about that that whole scenario plays out probably in a couple minutes. I gotta say, one thing which was a happy surprise about this episode, because I think we got the meeting between Mike and Gus Fring maybe a little sooner than I was expecting. They didn't waste time here, which is funny the way people have been talking. Oh, they're taking too long with stuff. Shut up, people. That was really, it was a cool meeting because it was, it reminded me again, we're going to have to keep referencing Breaking Bad now, because we're talking about Gus Fring. It seemed like there were a number of other times he would meet someone in some stretch of road or desert, and it's always beautifully shot, and this was no exception, right?
Yeah, Shyban does a good job with this kind of stuff, and I mean, they definitely, I just love how they continue to find really cool ways to like line up shots, you know, all around Albuquerque. I mean, they shot this kind of, I'd say, to the west of town, because you can just kind of tell based on the location of Sandia Crest Mountain, like where they were, and you know, there's just lots of all sorts of, you know, wild, dusty roads. There's not a lot of traffic out there, but right. they just managed to, like, every time they find anything, it just ends up looking really freaking sweet.
Yeah, and combined with the fact it's beautifully shot, it's kind of a fun scene. I mean, the fact that Mike, right off the bat, he holds up the note that said don't, and he just simply says, care to explain this? That's great stuff. That's pure Mike. Because the one thing about Mike, he's not intimidated, and most anyone else in this situation would be kind of at least unnerved. Have we ever seen Mike get unnerved? I don't know if that's even happened at any point in time. But what I like is just from the get-go here, right off the bat, you realize, and I think these men realize, that they're not really actually in opposition to each other. Which is interesting, because we know what's eventually these two are going to, you know, Mike's going to end up working for this guy. But I guess because it's clear to Mike that Hector is not Fring's ally, but actually the competition. So, you know, and I wonder if, even at this point in time, and this is 2000, oh, now I'm forgetting what year it was, whatever, it's a few years ago. Is it 2007? Is it supposed to be like 2007, I think?
I can never remember what the show, I don't even remember what year Breaking Bad took place. And I love Breaking Bad.
Well, I know when you got to towards the last year or two of Breaking Bad, it was 2009 and 10 and 2010. So like season 4 is in 2009. That I know for Breaking Bad. So this actually might be further back then. I'm not really sure. Anyway, I don't want to get too hung up on dates here. But I was already imagining that Fring is himself already imagining when he can slaughter the cartel, probably with Hector included at that point. So it kind of makes all the dialogue that Fring says here to have a bit more portent to it, because you know he is planning something. It may be, you know, a couple years down the line.
I'm looking forward to whenever, you know, that luxury of time happens again, watching Breaking Bad again, knowing that they when they were making this show, they watched it some, and they kind of, you know, I'm not sure if they tried to marry it exactly to what you see in the show, but I think there will be things that we see in Breaking Bad that, like, we'll view those a lot differently, because we've seen stuff here, and it'll be interesting, like, doing that, like, kind of ass backwards and just seeing, like, what kind of experience it is this time, and just like, oh, that's what he's talking about there. Like, oh, yeah, I remember seeing that, like, when they aired it 7 years later.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I mean, just Mike alone, it's going to make a lot of the scenes with Mike that much more interesting to watch with a different point of view. Like his scenes with Jesse, knowing, now that we actually know more about Mike's backstory, or when he tells that first story, when he tells the half-measure story to Walt, it takes on an entirely different significance now that we've seen more of Mike's story. I mean, say nothing of the Jimmy/Saul stuff, but we're not there yet in this episode.
No, I think there definitely will be cases where it'll be, you know, having watched the sequel, will make the original show, like, you know, even though it's basically flawless in the first place, I mean, it'll definitely improve at least certain parts of the show to us, and that's really a, you know, an interesting dynamic, the way it works out like that.
Well, I think to a large extent, Gilligan and Gould are also using this as a way of, you know, of filling in, you know, possible gaps or ideas that they didn't get to do in Breaking Bad. I mean, a lot of times when, that's interesting, a lot of times when you're writing, whether it be a TV series or a screenplay, whatever, you may actually write an entire biography of a character, and 75% of those details will never be on screen. But it's just something that you know. Quite often the actor knows. Now, as they've talked frequently about Breaking Bad, they often, you know, went into a season not having mapped the whole thing out quite just yet, which boggles my mind when you see the excellence of that show. But I think to a large extent they got the chance to write those bios much later on. Like maybe they might not have had Mike's whole story figured out during Breaking Bad. I think going into this, they did. I think that's probably one of the first things they figured out was what was Mike's real story here. And that's how we got like 5-0 back in season one. And we keep getting little pieces of it, you know, or feelings of it since then, I think. Also, something I really love about this sequence, or the scene, I should say, rather, I just love the contrast between these two actors and these two characters and how different they are. I mean, Fring is very eloquent with the way he speaks, and Mike doesn't use very many words. He's more about his expressions. But you can see there's a certain rapport between them almost instantly, which is really kind of fun to see how, you know, how these two men are eventually going to enter a working relationship at some point in the future. But you, at this point, you're still wondering, how and when and why is that going to work? But it's kind of fun at this point to see it, the beginnings of it, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I'm watching Breaking Bad. I doubt either one of us gave it a lot of thought, like, you know, what kind of relationship that these two had before what we saw presented on that show. But there's definitely, you know, just based on this scene and a little, you know, bits and pieces we've seen in the season before, just having how these guys are acting, without having met yet. I mean, there's just a ton of potential for like really sweet stuff happening. There's just going to be like, you know, we're just going to eat that shit up.
Yep, that's why we're watching. Well, it's not the only reason we're watching, but it's a major reason. So later, I mean, before we really even know what Mike's overall plan turns out to be, there's that part where he's clearly been sent to an associate of Fring to get a package of drugs. Although I love that Mike doesn't know weight numbers, he just knows it's like yay big. Did you recognize the doctor at the clinic that he goes to?
Yeah, he's the one that deals with Gus after he drinks the poison and Salute. I mean, I guess he deals, you know, that's when he drinks the poison, but that's him, right?
I think so. He's in a couple episodes from Breaking Bad.
Because he was the guy. Yeah, he was in Mexico, and then, you know, Jesse brought him to, and then the guy didn't want to fix up Mike because he just didn't give a shit.
Right. Exactly.
Which is interesting.
Here's something else that's interesting about that character, which I didn't. Mr. Breaking Bad fan over here didn't realize. Did you know what the character's name is?
No, I don't believe so.
Here's what's interesting. That character's name, and you'd assume, you know, because it's a safe assumption normally, that, you know, he's clearly, you know, of Latino descent or maybe Mexican or whatever, you'd assume he'd have a name like that. It's not. His name is Dr. Barry Goodman. Huh. So it's kind of strange that they use the name Goodman, and we know why that's a little strange. I still have to believe it's just an odd coincidental choice by a writer a few years back, because I can't imagine this character would have anything to do with the name that Jimmy eventually picks. But it's still kind of a strange thing, so I just felt, because I don't think anyone ever hears that character's name, but I looked it up, like, Dr. Barry Goodman. I was like, okay, very strange.
<That's weird.
laughs> Don't know why they did it that way. So then, of course, we see Mike has that other package, the pair of the big bright red sneakers. It wasn't until I saw the sneakers that all of a sudden that opening that we were talking about started to coalesce in my mind. Like, oh, those are those sneakers. Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, same here. It took me a little while, actually, until I saw the stop sign that I realized, like, oh, okay, you know, like that takes place, you know, a good deal of time after that.
Right. And it's one of those things you start trying to piece together what the scheme is, because in that moment, when he keeps trying to throw the sneakers up on the wire, which, and I love that they took their time with that. I mean, I think he did it on the third try, but from what I understand, as talented as Jonathan Banks is, he couldn't quite pull that off. So there were some special effects and other things done to get that. It wasn't like the pizza situation from Walter White and Bryan Cranston, whatever. Yes, I know. Let's not go down that rabbit hole. Have you mentioned Star Trek yet? Anyway.
I'm getting there.
I know. So I'm going to confess, I wasn't sure what he was doing until the moment when those guys in the Regalo Heldado truck are thinking that those random bursts of gunfire of his were simply that of hunters. And then all of a sudden, that it took it that long for me to click, like, oh, I see what he's going to do here. You know, that's why there's all those bullet holes and the signs in the area and all this other crap, all right. But it's kind of an ingenious little plan, you know, because obviously, I mean, he had the drugs in the sneaker, shoot the sneaker, sprinkles on the truck, and then at the border, the customs, the dogs are definitely going to smell it, because, you know, dogs have an amazing sense of smell. I talked about it on Facebook. It's literally, you could have just done, you know, a couple, you know, dots of whatever the drug was, and a dog would detect it. So,
oh, that's true. I had to deal with that once on my way back from one of my vacations, coming back from Colorado through South Dakota. I got pulled over for going 1 mile over. And since I was, like, you know, a white dude by himself in a Prius, you know, the motherfucker profiled me, and the dog, he asked if the dog could do a sweep, whatever, and of course the dog smelled something, and, you know, and it probably was just, like, you know, somebody at my workplace, you know, smoked something near the car, you know, a week before, or maybe the I bought some snowshoes at a used gear shop that was kind of, you know, kind of interesting near Jackson Hole, and, you know, nothing smelled like anything, but those dogs can smell, I mean, you know, a few molecules of that shit, and they're, you know, they are amazing creatures, so it does not take much.
Yeah, it's one of those things where on the side of it, you're like, could that really happen? Like, when you realize a dog's sense of smell is like 10,000 times stronger than that of a human, and I don't think we can even comprehend what that would mean. Like if you or I had a sense of smell like a dog, we would be like the worst superhero ever. But that would be our superpower. It would be like the worst version of Daredevil. Oh, he can smell a mile away or something. That's great.
Yeah, the cocaine definitely would have, you know, it would have stayed on there. I mean, it wouldn't just blow off. Just the way, like, a vehicle travels, you know, it kind of creates a slipstream, and stuff just kind of, you know, builds up around the back and just stays there. So, you know, while some of it would blow off, I mean, you wouldn't believe the pile of shit that ends up at the back of the Prius when I drive on a dirt road. I mean, when I'm done, there's just, you know, an inch of that stuff there. So it just kind of, you know, just stuff hangs out in that part of a vehicle. So it's a, you know, they did the research, and it was a very well thought out plan by Mr. Ehrmantraut.
Now, the interesting thing is this plan. So obviously these guys get, the drivers get busted by customs. Now, it's interesting, like, you wonder how far an impact this has on Hector, because now they know it's this truck, it's this company, whatever. Is this going to put him under surveillance? Is he going to put under suspicion? Are they going to be, you know, tracking him more than they would have before? I think it has a more major impact on him than just, like, robbing another truck. So that's what makes it
much more interesting. Right, and they definitely showed that by, you know, the juxtaposition of the, you know, a Los Pollos truck using the same route instead of the, you know, whatever market or whatever was it Hector was using. They definitely, you know, they showed that for sure, that, like, you know, this is what Hector used to do, and now Gus is doing this shit.
Right. All right, so I think we could switch gears over to Jimmy. And really, it's a lot of this was like the Jimmy and Chuck show. I loved that scene with Jimmy, you know, just sitting, you know, kind of forlornly on the curb, smoking that stale cigarette and whatever. And then Chuck comes out with that utter bullshit speech to him.
Oh,
about how
I've been talking like that before, and I hate it.
Oh my God, this is all for his own good. He'll be a better man for it, you know, a good man, haha, whatever. Wow. And this is, I think it was like that moment, even more so than what we see later. All the people who were already like Chuck haters, I think I'll tip my hat off to them. It's like, yeah, you guys are getting vindicated big time in this episode, because it's really hard to feel sympathetic at all to Chuck at this point. He's downright hateful at this point, because he's still going through with something. And then when we find out what it really is, that doesn't make it any better. That just means that actually makes it more fucking evil in a weird way. It's just like, oh, there's yet another step in your fucking plan here.
Yeah, it's hard to sympathize with somebody's, you know, quest for righteous justice when it becomes self-righteousness justice.
Right.
Or self-righteousness, yeah.
And you notice how when all this is happening, you know, Chuck seems perfectly okay being outside and in the sun and, you know, not a whiff of his usual issues, whatever. Kind of interesting. But when Jimmy replies to him, the whole thing about dying alone, part of me was thinking, are they foreshadowing what Chuck's eventual fate is going to be here?
Huh.
Which kind of sort of makes sense to me, because I can imagine that will happen, because I got to wonder, like, at this point, is Jimmy finally going to wash his hands of his brother for once and for all? Which, quite frankly, I think he should have done and would have done after that big blowout at the end of season one. But, you know, he kept trying to have faith in him, you know, believe the better of his brother. I think at this point, I think there's no going back. I can't imagine there's any going back at this point.
No, and I definitely got the impression here, too, that, I mean, like, Chuck was realizing that he's kind of screwed. Because, I mean, if, like, something happens, like his, you know, getting tased, freak out thing again, and like, mm-hmm. you know, Jimmy's the only one keeping him from getting committed. Jimmy's not going to do that anymore, man.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're walking on a fucking tightrope now, and you better watch yourself.
Yeah, there's no one in his corner now. What, do you think Howard's going to help you? No, Howard would love to see you just go bye-bye and just and not have your drama dealing with the practice anymore. I mean, again, he uses Ernesto. Clearly, he uses him as a tool to pull off this whole scheme. And then he essentially has him fired for doing exactly what he planned, what he knew he was going to do. That's the kind of scumbag Chuck turns out to be in this episode. Huh.
This scene, too, I had the thought, just, you know, watching how the actors were playing this and how just, you know, just chilling and, you know, and how Chuck was being smarmy and Jimmy is just like, you know, so matter of fact. I'm just like, just imagine somebody watching like really early comedic appearances of these two. I mean, just imagine like watching Laverne and Shirley and then just like just seeing the work these fuckers are going to be kicking out in the future. I mean,
yeah,
it's
astonishing.
Actors like comedic actors haven't always gotten, you know, tons of props over the course of, you know, the decades, but you know, this is definitely, you know, between these guys and Cranston, I mean, you know, they're definitely good at casting good people and just letting them do their thing and just really proving that, like, you know, some of these guys are just fucking amazing. And these two are just awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really, I mean, I always admire the work that McKean does on the show, but I thought this was a really strong episode for Odenkirk. Several scenes that just could have played a lot of different ways, but there's a certain resonance with his performance that has, you know, whether he's, you know, depressed or angry or whatever, but he just does it in just a slightly different way, which kind of makes it that much more appealing. Whether it's scenes with his brother or scenes when he's going through the whole process of being, where he has to stay in lockup for the night or whatever, and he's being fingerprinted and all the stuff with that attorney. And even when he goes to Kim later on, and has that whole spiel about how this is all his, basically admitting this is all his fault, that he totally fell for it like a schmuck and the whole thing, that he got played like a fiddle. And he's like, yeah, he's absolutely right. But I just love his performance. And what's great about his performance is everything we're seeing is not the kind of stuff that we generally got to see him do when he was Saul Goodman as Breaking Bad. It's really showing
right.
it's a different stage in his life. It's almost practically a different character, and I really get a kick out of that. What I really like about the show in general with Odenkirk, it's in many ways it's made us almost forget that he's going to be Saul Goodman, you know, the guy who truly is a criminal lawyer, you know the way, you know, Jesse Pinkman accentuated those words, you know, back when we introduced his character in Breaking Bad. So, but what's kind of I hate to keep using words like tragic for the show, though there is still always going to be a certain tragic nature for the show because we know where it's eventually leading to, is the fact that what Chuck foresees about Jimmy and is trying to prevent from happening, even though he's doing it in this horrible, borderline evil way, actually does happen. And what's interesting to me, and I wonder what you think about this, I'm kind of thinking that to a certain extent, maybe a large extent, it's Chuck's shenanigans that in many ways push Jimmy to become that thing that Chuck was so worried about in the first place.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, even going back to when he screwed him over at the at Hamlin, blah, 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 at the law firm, and not, without him being able to get a spot there. I mean, this has been going on for years before all the stuff that's going on now. I'm just wondering if it's, I mean, I'm not going to say he's totally to blame, but I think Chuck shares a big part of blame of the eventual transformation, the supposed transformation to Saul Goodman, I think.
Right. Well, I definitely think at some point in the future, I mean, we're probably going to see something just really, really traumatic happen that just completely, like, wipes out Jimmy and turns to, you know, full Saul. Because, I mean, if you think about, like, Breaking Bad, you know, scenes where just really crazy stuff is going down, like, you know, Saul's on his knees, you know, getting threatened, you know, about to get shot by, you know, masked gunmen before an open grave, you know, when Mike's beating him up or Walt's beating him up, serious shit's going down. And I mean, he's in full Saul character there. I mean, there's no anything, and he's just, you know, completely became that person. So I'm just guessing at some point, you know, something just really insane's going to happen. And I'm guessing when we see that happen, it's going to be, I mean, it's just going to be just devastating for us as a viewer. But at some point, you know, I think we're going to see something like that.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, granted, we don't actually know, you know, what that turning point's going to be or when it's going to be. And it's interesting. Will it be something a bit more, something, as you say, something like a dramatic transformation? Or are we watching a more gradual piece by piece of his soul being chipped away kind of a transformation thing happening, which is kind of, to a certain extent, what they kind of did with Walter White in Breaking Bad, because they're kind of doing a similar thing here. Maybe the fall, maybe the change isn't quite as dramatic, you know, because you're already dealing with a guy who had a past as a con man, and then he kind of becomes sort of that way as a lawyer eventually, but it's, maybe he just becomes a less empathetic to others. I'm not really sure. But who knows? Like, again, I think we've talked about this. I mean, there's still a chance. I don't think so. There's still a chance we might not ever see him become Saul Goodman on the show. I don't know if they've actually said for sure he will be Saul on the show or not. I mean, I'm assuming he will be. But, you know, it remains to be seen. I'm assuming he will go that way.
Yeah, I'd be fine if they didn't, but I mean, since they could spend some time showing him his Saul if they wanted to, and they seem to be just having just an absolute blast filming the show, and we're totally benefiting from everything they do. So I'd be, you know, they could spend decades doing this stuff and just, you know, all hanging around Albuquerque, you know, hiring some cool people to do stuff and just, you know, shooting stuff in the desert and making me want to go there like really fucking bad. I mean, they can just do it forever if I like care.
I think, but realistically, I think they do have to adhere to some form of a timeline. That's why I've totally forgotten. I didn't look at my Better Call Saul wiki or anything beforehand to bone up on the dates. I remember there was a date on the check in the very first season, which now escapes my memory. So I apologize for not remembering that. I should know when this is all taking place. I'm drawing a blank right now. I did not make a note of it before the podcast.
They can just make like one season and like an episode of 24 where it just takes place in one day. And they can just do that. If Mike won really intense fucking Mike day, go for it.
I know that, but maybe. Other shows have done that and they've been horrible. So I don't actually want them to do that if they can avoid it. But we'll see. We don't know what the heck they're going to do. So a couple final and maybe important details about, you know, that we haven't gotten to here. A couple things I want to mention to you. Getting back to Chuck, the fact that he meets with that assigned ADA from out of town, Miss Hay, who I recognize is played by the actress Kimberly Herbert Gregory, who I know you and I saw on the HBO series Vice Principals.
Yep.
So that was kind of fun to see her here. And that's when you realized, you know, he's still, first of all, Chuck is still a fucking bullshit artist. You know, with the way he's talking about his brother, it's like, yeah, fuck off, liar. But then that's the part where you realize, oh, there's another layer to the plan, which we then, we don't find out until, you know, the last scene of the episode between Jimmy and Kim. Now, apparently, to avoid a trial, they make an offer to him, a PPD, which is a pre-prosecution diversion. So essentially he's got to confess to everything, but I guess then it's like the sword of Damocles that's held over his head for a year. And, you know, if he keeps his nose clean, you know, that I don't know if at that point he's fine or he gets expunged or what happens. It's all about avoiding serving any jail time. But why Chuck is doing this, the whole point of it, is that this gets reported back to the New Mexico Bar Association. You know, and because there's that stupid little fourth degree felony in there specifically, it's going to mean almost certain disbarment. I mean, felony means disbarment, period. So that's when you know, oh, this was never about, you know, Jimmy learning a lesson and going, you know, spending some time in jail. He just doesn't want him to be a lawyer anymore. So in a way, I guess it almost goes all the way back to that flashback we had, I think it was last season, before Jimmy had chosen to pursue the law, where he was kind of insulting the idea of being a lawyer at that dinner with Chuck and Rebecca. Wasn't that what happened? He was like making the lawyer. He was making the lawyer jokes, which were pissing off Chuck. So I mean, and then I guess some weird reason Chuck has never seemed to have let go of that. And you know, I know there's more to that story that we just haven't seen yet. So, but maybe Chuck is so pious where he thinks if you don't take the law seriously from the get go, then you don't deserve to be a lawyer or something. I don't know.
Anything else we want to talk about? I like seeing the prosecutor again. It's a, you know, he's just kind of a, you know, a goofy character. I'd like to see them bring him back.
I love when they bring back. I love when they bring back any characters that we had almost forgotten about from like the previous season or two or whatever. So yeah, I did enjoy seeing him. You know, we didn't talk a little bit about Kim. You know, I do worry that, you know, being involved in this case, that I don't want her to end up botching something on the Mesa Verde case, because we see that she's already working around the clock. It's not like she doesn't even go home, but she's sleeping in the office and showering at the local gym. So we got that really quick, cute little mini montage with her, which is kind of nice. I wonder if we're actually going to get to see some actual court action here, because it looks like they're going to trial. So that could be kind of fun.
Yeah, I think they're going to be doing that. So that should be interesting. That's what they do.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I or both of us love this show, I guess there is the only thing that kind of hurts it just a little bit, is, well, we know he doesn't lose his license. So it kind of robs a little bit of urgency and drama from the storyline. I mean, obviously we're still looking forward to it because we want to know what happens. But it just takes a little bit away. It's kind of like Rogue One, the Star Wars movie. Like, well, we know they're going to get the plans to them because that's how Star Wars starts. That they got the plans. You know, it's still fun to see how we get there, but it doesn't. There's not the drama like, oh, maybe they won't. No, yeah, we know they won't because that's
yeah. I don't know unless you can lose your license and like, you know, get it again.
No,
I mean I'm not sure how all this works, but I mean, you know, the name of, you know, it is Saul Goodman's name on his you know, University of American Samoa, like whatever.
Thing. Changing your name doesn't change the thing, especially if you're doing TV commercials in the same same city.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. That would be insane. All right. I think that's pretty much everything we got for Better Call Saul this week. So maybe we should head on down to Minnesota, round about your parts. Right? Yes. Okay. So let's head on over to Fargo. Now, the latest episode of Fargo was directed by Noah Hawley favorite, as well as one of ours, the great Michael Uppendahl, and it was written by Hawley himself. Now, the latest Bridge-related title this week, and I just realized something I forgot to mention in Better Call Saul. God damn it. Oh, well. Did I ever say what the title of the Better Call Saul episode was? It was Sunk Cost, but I ever explained what it meant? Eh, who cares? Guys can look it up online. Anyway, but back to Fargo. The title is The Principle of Restricted Choice. So I'll trot out some little bit of the wiki definition here. The principle of restricted choice states that play of a particular card decreases the probability its player holds any equivalent card. Well, you know, there's examples and paragraphs I could go through, but chances are I'll just muddy the waters and make it more confusing than it needs to be. You know, so If you were paying attention to that definition, you can kind of sort of try to figure out why that relates to this episode. It's really about it's trying to figure out what someone else is holding, and you know, once they've made a move, you're like, okay, that means they can't be doing, they're not going to be able to do this because they've already done that or something like that, I guess. Let's just talk about the episode. So sticking with the avoidance of doing a kind of recapping, I picked out some odd thematic elements I noticed in the episode, and want to see how our conversation kind of sprouts from there. First, there's this thing about computers in this episode, and how the issue of technology keeps manifesting throughout it. So let's start with another really great character name, Irv Blumkin, who turns out to be Emmett Stussy's attorney. And what happens to him? And how amazing would it be to have such power, I guess, that the moment anyone tries to even Google you, a virus is unleashed, something that seemed to take your picture, it looked like to me as well. That was pretty crazy. What'd you think of that?
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that at all, and of course they definitely weren't. So it was cool, just going from that, from like a character that has absolutely no, like, you can't even do a Google search, and then just getting completely captured by, just like a really, really amazing like technology trap. It was just like, just the contrast between that is just really awesome and funny.
Well, it was interesting because it plays funny. But there's something kind of oddly chilling about it as well in the moment, especially when you realize this can't lead to any good. And of course, it doesn't, because he gets killed, gets thrown off the garage by this Russian guy in the help of his partner Mimo. By the way, the Russian guy's name is Yuri Garga, which is the same name of the supposed girlfriend strangler back in East Berlin. But since that's 22 years earlier, it really can't be the same guy because he's not that old. So I was thinking about that. I was like, wait, are they just playing around again with the matter of extremely odd coincidences that keep happening on this show? Like the whole Ennis Stussy being mistaken for Emmett Stussy, even though they're actually no relation. And I think we find out a bit more why that would be the case later on in the episode. In fact, I think when Gloria digs a bit more into her stepfather's sci-fi pulp writing past, my impression is that Ennis Stussy is the fake name. That's his pseudonym in real life. And Thaddeus Mobley was the real name. Because that makes a bit more sense to me, because that would be why, like, Emmett wouldn't know who he is at all. Although, I confess, and you would know better than I do, I don't know, there could be hundreds of Stussys in Minnesota. But
yeah, it's not a name I've ever heard before. So I mean, it's the kind of thing that kind of sounds like something you would hear over there, like something that, like, it used to be like a Slavic type name, and then they just shortened it, I suppose.
Yeah,
but
it seems unlikely. So the fact that he changed his name to that, it makes a lot more sense that he wouldn't be in any way related to them or something along those lines, I guess. And speaking of Gloria, she's like insanely old school, apparently, which I couldn't decide. Like, maybe are they going a little bit too far with the quirkiness? Because as the character, I think the new chief of police says, Trump kind of reminds her of what the date is. Because this is 2010, and she's still, writing things down using telexes. And I don't know who's used telex even in this century, quite frankly. So that's kind of crazy. But I guess we find out that she hasn't even unboxed the computers that the previous chief had ordered. By the way, I didn't realize until this week, in this episode specifically, that the cop that we see, that's her, I'm not really sure, almost like was her deputy or subordinate or whatever he was. His name is Donnie in the episode. And by the way, they love the name Donnie and anything Coen Brothers related, of course. That's the part that was supposed to be Jim Gaffigan's part.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about him.
Yeah, apparently he had to back out of the show. He wasn't able to do the show after all, even though I saw him on a talk show, whatever number of months ago, talking like he was going to be on the show. He'd even had his little mustache that he was supposed to be for Fargo. So I don't know how long ago they shot these episodes, but it's a shame because I was really looking forward to seeing Gaffigan on this show, but it is what it is. He couldn't do it. But I thought I'd mention it because I've been wondering where he's been. I haven't seen him in any ads. I'm like, wait, but he got cast for this. Back to Gloria. We know that she doesn't seem to like computers, but it really seems that technology doesn't seem to be her friend at all, because her cell phone hardly works and that automatic door doesn't seem to see her when she's entering that store.
Yeah, I was laughing because Carrie Coon definitely wasn't having any luck with technology at all this week. Neither shall he or she.
Yeah, without
nice timing.
Right. I was thinking same exact thought. I mean, anyone watching The Leftovers this week, and not spoiling it for folks who are not up to date with that series, it's a very bizarre coincidence that Carrie Coon seems to have issues with technology, no matter what network she's on or what show she's on. It's very, very strange. I guess the stuff with Gloria, however, for me right now, and I know it's deliberate, I mean, they can't avoid it, I guess, it still feels like it doesn't really have any connection to the rest of the show. I mean, I know it's going to get there, because eventually she's going to be on to Ray, Stussy, and so on, whatever. But it still feels like it's very much a separate part from the rest of the show for me, more so than in the previous seasons when there was whenever a cop was on the initial trail of whatever crime was going on. Or maybe I don't care about as much about the crime in this season as the previous two seasons. Maybe there was more.
No, you definitely have a point. I mean, it does change the way, like, the tension of the character is, the tension of the plot. Because, I mean, in season one, you know, Molly was all over Lester, like, instantly. In season two, you had Lou dealing with the Gerhards. I mean, like, you know,
right,
having issues with them right away. It's, you know, so they really, you know, I mean, they, you know, it just, there's more time to see the characters, the good guys and the bad guys, bounce off each other if, like, they see each other earlier.
That's true. That's very true. So speaking of who she's going to be running into eventually, maybe next episode, maybe, who knows, Ray. Ray also had a computer issue in this episode. Apparently Vermin had eaten through his computer's power cord or something. Now, that doesn't really play much of a part in the episode beyond the fact that, I guess, he uses his colleague's computer to find the preliminary findings of the coroner report for Maurice. But I'm really just using it to pivot to talk about Ray in general or a little bit. You know, before I get to my other little thematic, whatever you whatchamacallit, that scene between Ray and Emmett Stussy, I mean, can we talk about how, just technically speaking, it was seamless?
I mean, I had the same thought. It's like, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, over the years, especially more recent years, because, you know, obviously, whether it be CGI or better types of cameras or whatever, you're able to pull off, you know, the doubling of people in the same frame a lot more convincingly than back in the day where you could look for the seam in the frame, you know, like on a soap opera,
yeah,
when you had twin actors, like, oh, look, they're right by that staircase because there's a line right in the middle of the
scene. I can't think of any TV shows where that's happened, like with the transporter accidents or anything. I just can't, nothing comes to mind.
Yeah.
Go on.
people were poised to take a shot right there. Like, he's going to say, he's going to, no. Anyway.
Dump it back in the bottle, guys.
So, but what's interesting, and story-wise, that little moment, it certainly told us something about these characters who, again, for me, are still far from the most interesting that we've seen in any series of Fargo as of yet. But at least we learned something about them, that these are two brothers who actually do, I think they do really care about each other and would like to move on with their lives. And it's actually, it's their partners, their right-hand men or women or whatever you want to call them, they're the ones who are really more instigating this feud between them, it seems to me. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I mean, Seinfeld. Oh, by the way, I'm really loving the Seinfeld character. That's one of the things I really took away from this week. Because, like, I love Seinfeld.
Yeah, oh, yeah. For me, the season really, like, started to feel like more something I was into the scene between Cy and Ray at the diner. I'm just like, I'm kind of enjoying
great,
the shit.
Great scene. I can hardly wait to talk. I want to talk about that so much. I mean, he clearly wants Emmett to have nothing to do with Ray, and Nikki. If there was any hope of reconciliation between these brothers, she pretty much dashes it with her own menstrual blood, I guess. and blood, actually, that's the other little weird thematic element I wanted to point out. Because before when Ray is walking to Nikki's building, they're still trying to clean that huge bloody stained sidewalk and the bloody snow. It's still out there. And, you know, then he goes to see her. One of the first things she mentions when she's straddling him, that she's on her period. Which made me go, ooh. And, of course, just to be silly about it, you've got this bad blood between Ray and Emmett. You have, you know, quote unquote, a blood feud to a certain extent. And then, but good Lord, when she mistakenly thinks that Emmett has hidden that stamp in like some safety deposit box or something, she gets bloody creative, which, yeah, not realizing that her man is actually burying the hatchet with her brother after all. I really see, I think, and again with this episode, and again, we saw it in the first one, but I think it's more overt in this one. She's a manipulator, and she's very much in that classic, almost a mall sense. I mean, she's not exactly up there with Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity, you know, but she's, to me, I think she's clearly the one in control in that couple. I think she's really calling the shots more than Ray might think he is from time to time, but I think she's more the alpha in that situation, if that makes any sense.
Right. Yeah.
And what's interesting is, you know, and she, maybe it's because she does have a stronger personality than him. So, like, flipping back to Cy, I think he's got a far stronger personality than Emmett. And, you know, so getting, let's, that diner scene. The fact that you, okay, first of all, the fact that you can see he's getting the chance to be the tough guy here. And you can see he's, like, he's really into it. Because he's incapable of doing that when he's around the Vargas character. But here, you know, with Ray, he's calling the shots. He's being Mr. Cool with the $20 bill and then all the shit. And then the stuff with his what is he at? Is it a Hummer? I didn't really see what kind of vehicle he's driving.
Yeah,
it's probably something like that. I love the fact that it's not, what makes that moment great is not that he chooses to smash into the Corvette a couple times, because that would be kind of okay, we've seen that. It's the fact that the idiot clips another parked car on his way out of the parking lot, which is just perfect, because in that moment, that little, those few seconds when it happens, talk about themes or metaphors, whatever, that's like for the entire season. Unintended collateral damage. If anything we're seeing in this show, and it's something we've seen in previous seasons of Fargo, but this season specifically, it's all about unintended collateral damage and who suffers as a result. This is a lesser extent. It's some poor waitress either a waitress or another customer. It's like, hey, man, he crashed into my car or whatever. But it's just really funny. I think Cy is a great character. He's definitely one of the reasons I think I enjoyed this episode a lot more than the premiere.
Right. Yeah. You know, and I'm not going to fault Ewan McGregor for this, because I just don't think they're giving him a lot to do at this point. But neither one of those characters is, you know, I'm sure you'll agree with me, but neither one of the characters is super compelling at the moment. And having the, I think it's kind of telling that the, you know, the side characters that are near them are the ones that we're actually, like, enjoying more at this point. So hopefully they will, they'll correct that. But for now, I'd say the show is like a, you know, an inverted True Detective season one.
Yes, oh, actually, I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah, that is a problem for me as well. I find them to be the least compelling characters that we've met on the show so far, and the side characters are really, they're also initiating and driving more of the action. So you have that. Emmett doesn't really. I mean, Emmett's a little bit more interesting this episode than the previous one, but he's still kind of, eh. You know, and Ray's kind of a schmuck, who's kind of just under his girlfriend's thumb and without really seeming to realize that he is. So it's just, yeah, they're not that compelling.
They're both very weak people. Not like, you know, kind of, like, and we haven't seen any, like, you know, at least when you saw Lester being weak, there was actually, like, you know, he was acting out, and we saw that relatively early. But these guys are just kind of, like, you know, submissive and I don't know.
They were just more, but also, the characters that we can kind of sort of make the connection to in the previous seasons of Fargo. I mean, clearly Lester in season one, and like I said, the closest you can come to it in season two is probably the characters played by Kirsten Dunst and what's his name?
Jesse Plemons.
Yes, right. Thank you. It's hard. Season two is a little weird. You know, it's a bit harder to nail down. But more of the people who were not initially involved in a criminal enterprise who get who end up doing things that they shouldn't have done, you know, and then get wrapped up in the whole thing. So that's as close as you get. But both those, either be that coupling or Lester, they just had scenes that just popped more. They just had scenes that were just made you sit up and watch more. And we haven't had that with these. I mean, Lester, I mean, he's the one who kills his wife right off in that episode, right? I mean,
oh yeah.
So we get that right off the bat with him. And quite frankly, technically, that's what Kirsten Dunst. She's the one who hits the guy with a car, and then everything they do to get rid of the body. Or so they're more involved in everything going on. In this, I mean, someone has been killed, but someone else did it, and they just made a mistake based on instructions that Ray gave him. I mean, I guess he does kick the air conditioner out and crushes the guy, but even that's Nikki's idea. She's the one who's doing it up until the last minute where he finally kicks it with her. But and she's also handling it a lot better than he is too. So again, yeah, I agree. They're far more, and I think you said passive. They're far more passive characters than we'd seen with these others in the previous seasons, and that always is going to hurt storytelling, quite frankly. Passivity.
We're not going to be able to get invested in characters that don't have like any agency, and like just we have no reason to give a crap about them at the moment. They're just kind of schlubs. So until they, you know, start to, I mean, at least, you know, if they behave as bastards at some point, like really hardcore or something, then, you know, we can find a way to get behind that, you know, more so than just when they're just kind of, you know, just along for the ride.
Yeah. So there's another character I think we need to talk about a bit here, who definitely merits some talking time here. And it's really where the episode goes and closes with him, although we saw him early in the episode. The guy who really, so far, is the main evil presence on the show, the VM Vargas, and his two lackeys, I guess. It's David Theulis. Okay, on one hand, I'm really enjoying his performance. He's definitely having fun. He's definitely, you know, tasting the scenery, so to speak. Maybe his dialogue is a little too much gilding the lily, so to speak, when he goes on about the different exotic locales. You know, I love his commentary about Minnesota and the whole bland thing. I just didn't know if we need to go on and on about the African continent or whatever. But other than that, he's very much a fun character. You know, I wouldn't quite put him in the same category as Billy Bob Thornton's character from season one, but you see they're kind of like in that same range, so to speak, you know.
Yeah, I kind of like, one thing I like about this character, I mean, we've seen this kind of character a lot, you know, in like every James Bond movie ever, but with him, like the stuff that comes out of his mouth is just like, everything he says, you expect him to say something different, and he's just saying just all this weird random stuff in different ways. Like, it's just goofy and fun, but it's just nice because it really, like, you know, it subverts our expectations.
Yes, right. And even the way he just responds, even to the guy at the toll booth for the parking lot. I mean, just the use of the word surmise. It's like, I don't think anyone would ever use that word in that situation in that way. And it struck me as strange. Now, speaking of strange, I do kind of wonder something. It's a really basic thing, and I don't like the fact I'm wondering it. So from the get-go, from going back to the premiere, I'm trying to figure out, and I might be missing something. So why exactly couldn't Emmett and Cy go to the authorities from the get-go here? It's just a bit of a plot hole for me that it's harder for me to ignore than on other TV series. Because, I mean, I expect things to be really buttoned up pretty well by Noah Hawley. I'm not sure why they couldn't have gone to the authorities from the get-go.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that works. I mean, maybe, you know, I suppose, you know, the government makes you pay taxes for, like, every fucking thing you do. So I suppose whatever avenue they use to do this, I mean,
Well, they borrowed money, you know, and now they're paying it back with presumably with interest. I mean, even if you went to a loan shark, which, you know, you could say this in a way, maybe this kind of sort of was, because I think they say in the first episode that they weren't able to get a loan from anyone else. I think they'd gone around. So it's not about, oh, they don't want people to know that they were in financial. Well, they already know that because you went to other banks and you couldn't get, you know, $1 million from anybody else. But even so, even so, even if it was perhaps some sort of tax situation, which is possible, it still seems that they would rather do that than go along with this enterprise. It's one of those things. Obviously, as the series goes out, I'm gonna have to let it go because that's just the way it is. But it's something I would love to have an explanation for. Maybe I'll see some interview, maybe with Steppenwolf or someone else, with Noah Hawley, and that someone will just ask that question. And I'll be like, oh, and Hawley can answer it for me. But it is kind of, after two episodes, I keep thinking, wait, why couldn't they just go to the authorities?
I don't get the impression that they're like, you know, Parking Lot Enterprise is like super criminal. I mean, they kind of like, you know, look like that kind of group. But we were used to seeing that kind of group, you know, in Fargo specifically. So we're just, you know, maybe I just assume that they're criminals, but they haven't behaved in that way in any. So I guess maybe they're just normal businessmen. Well, they could be.
Well, I think Emmett and Sy, I think they're legitimate. I don't think there's anything criminal about their enterprise at all. Just based on the way they're acting, they certainly don't think that. I mean, I don't want to say they're too stupid to be criminals, but yeah, kind of. So again, it doesn't bother me as enough to not want to watch the show or anything. But it just, I do question it. I do think there should have been something that this criminal organization had over them that would prevent them from, you know, even if it was something as simple as they threatened. I mean, I don't remember this happening. If they were on their lives or the lives of their loved ones were being threatened or something like that, I don't know. Because clearly they seem to have very little issue about killing people. Although, I wondered another thing. So, back to the beginning, Irv googling VM Vargas, and that's which triggered something where, you know, we see it looks like his photo is taken in the computer and then everything goes black. But his assistant, or whatever she is, her face was in that picture too. So shouldn't she get killed?
Yeah, I'm guessing, you know, her days are also numbered. I'm not really sure why they wouldn't have done that in this episode. I mean, how it'll serve the story to not do it now, but presumably her days are numbered.
I guess we'll see. I mean, if not, then that's it's a minor hole, but just kind of like, wait, what? There were a couple. Before we wrap this episode up, I do want to, because I really did enjoy this episode, even though it might sound like I didn't. I really liked it better than the premiere, quite frankly. I think I laughed more during this episode also, which is a nice thing. When Sy says slave girls, I love that. I love that. It's like, I was thinking drugs, slave girl. Why would you be thinking slave girl? I thought that was fantastic. And there was a line that Nikki had that I really kind of liked. When Ray says, refers to her as being a con, and she says, I hate that word, con. It's so negative. That's very funny. That's very clever. I don't know. Like I said, that's really all I have for this episode. I definitely enjoyed it at least a few degrees more than last week. Hoping in later episodes we get to see that more of a connect between Glory and the rest of the show. We know that's going to happen, so I'm not worried about that. As far as the brothers, all I can say is, and I think you might agree with me on this, I'm hoping that desperation leads them to make like really bad decisions and consequences that'll make their scenes a lot more compelling for us to watch. Because that's where, yeah, I think it'll start to work.
We need things to escalate. I mean, the show definitely seems to be on an uptick, and hopefully it'll continue to do that. But we really need like an episode that's just like completely freaking sweet and just have something that, like, you know, we want to talk about. Like, we want to just jump on the fucking podcast and talk about it.
Yeah.
And for now, we're basically just, you know, it's not a bad show and there's some cool stuff. But you know, we're just going through the motions right now and it's not super joyful to talk about.
Yeah, because right now, I mean, Emmett, right now he's being seriously inconvenienced by these guys, you know, taking up, you know, a wing in his office, and they're going to start laundering money. But it's like, okay, and right? And Ray, I mean, the coroner already put it down as an accident. So in his way of thinking, he may still be a little bit nervous about it. But right now, it looks like his feeling should be, we kind of got away with this. So I'm not feeling that sense of, again, I'll use that phrase, that sense of urgency or, oh, fuck with the two of them. And I think for this to really start working better, you need that to be happening. You know, and think about how freaked out Lester was all the time, you know, in every episode. And then and that's which led to him becoming a worse person, so to speak, in Fargo, season one. I think they need something along those lines to be happening here as well. All right. I think we've done it for both episodes. I think it's time to wrap this up.
Yep.
All right.
Please
so,
do.
So let's wrap this up. If you enjoy this podcast, then you should enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page. Find us on Facebook. We're the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Like the page and join the conversation about any number of TV shows like Fargo and Better Call Saul. You can also find us on iTunes the very same way, the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Type that in. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us there. And finally, you can follow us on the Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. And that's it for tonight. We look forward to getting together with you guys next week to talk about both Better Call Saul and Fargo. So until then, I'll say thanks for being there, Dan, and good night.
Good night.